Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our number two of the program. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of our show, we'll be talking about current events in Pakistan. Since 1999, the government has been in the hands of General Pervez Musharraf. He took power in that year in a bloodless coup. And since that time, he has been not only the civilian leader as president, he has continued to be the head of the military. And that is something, the fact that he held both of those jobs, holds both of those jobs, has continued to be controversial since. Pakistan is scheduled to hold elections this year, and many people expect that General Musharraf will stand again. And he has faced growing opposition over his intention to run for another term. And over the past couple of months, that opposition has coalesced around a particular figure, and that is the man who was the head of Pakistan's Supreme Court. This morning we'll be talking about this current conflict between General Musharraf and his opponents, and perhaps also talk a little bit about the state of relations between Pakistan, the United States, and India, how that triangle is all working out these days. And our guest for the program is Frederick Grahr. He is visiting scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a leading expert and writer on South Asia. He served most recently in the French Embassy in Pakistan, and from 1999 until 2003 in New Delhi as director of the Center for Social Sciences and Humanities. He has written extensively on security issues, Islamist movements, and sectarian conflict in Pakistan and Afghanistan. He is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that they are brief and keep their comments short so that we can keep our program moving and then get in as many different people as possible. I'd like to involve listeners in the conversation. So if you're interested in calling in, you have a question, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Grahr, hello.
Yes, good afternoon.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Just as a way of background to talk a little bit about where things stand now and about the this protest that's been going on now ever since the beginning of March, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the firing of Mr. Chaudhry, the head of the Supreme Court. This happened on the 9th of March. General Musharraf fired the country's chief justice, and one might find this a little bit surprising. At least it was my understanding that Mr. Chaudhry had previously been someone you might expect would support the government and support General Musharraf, and that was why he was on the Supreme Court in the first place. What led to this conflict between General Musharraf and Mr. Justice Chaudhry?
Well, the evolution of Judge Chaudhry is certainly still a mystery, at least it's a mystery to me. But as you said, it was a surprise for everyone that the conflict erupted at that specific period of time. Judge Chaudhry condemned the disappearance of people, especially in Balochistan, the illegal detention by the intelligence agencies, and so on and so forth. And I think, more to the point, did question the constitutionality of Pervez Musharraf holding the dual hat of Chief of Army Staff and President. And that's probably what triggered the whole process. As I understand it, Pervez Musharraf was advised to get rid of the problem early rather than later because it would be easier to deal with. And the fact is there had been interferences with the judiciary in almost every single Pakistani government, be they civilian or military. But it never generated the kind of reaction that we did observe that time, which leads me to believe that the society in itself was also mature for that, the kind of reaction that we have seen.
Mm. I know that a lot of people have said, have pointed to these protests that have gone on now ever since General Musharraf dismissed Mr. Chaudhry, as saying that this looks like it may well be the greatest challenge, or is the greatest challenge to General Musharraf since he took power in 1999. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that is correct?
That is certainly the greatest challenge to Pervez Musharraf for a number of reasons. A, this is something that he seems now unable to stop, because all judges have shown their solidarity with Chaudhry. I mean, more than 12 judges from the various high court around the country have resigned since March 9th. And a number of high figures in the judiciary have resigned since March 9th. At the same time, for the first time, for the very first time, the issue is really about democracy, the rule of law, constitution, and so on. I mean, and it's very difficult this time for anybody to argue of any kind of state of emergency, any kind of security issue actually threatening the country, which would justify military intervention or whatever. This is really about what the regime has always been. This is a military regime which is not respecting the constitution that itself pretend to respect, and so on and so forth. This is really a crisis of democracy in Pakistan. That makes it extremely difficult to manage. On top of that, you have the role of the media. And what happened over the last 2 days is extremely interesting. Mm-hmm. Monday, the president issued an ordinance, a new ordinance, allowing the authority to seize all the equipment of broadcasters, close down the premises of television channels, and so on, without even any consultation. It is now coming back on its own decision. In other words, this government is not knowing what to do, is not knowing how to do it, and seems to be increasingly in a state of panic and definitely in a total mess.
Well, and I think also just now here recently we have a story. This was just today being reported by Reuters, mm-hmm. with the president actually complaining that his party, his supporters had left him, that they weren't supporting him. He was saying, "Look, where are you?" And he is complaining very bitterly that he seems to feel he's being isolated even by his own supporters.
Yes, that's an indication that he's, as he said, totally isolated, that the anger in the country is larger than just a group of lawyers, and that he has absolutely no constituency whatsoever except perhaps with the army. And therefore, the key question in the coming days, weeks, and eventually months is what is the role of the army going to be? But there was also something else this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday it was announced by the president's office that he would address the nation tonight, 8 p.m. tonight Pakistan time. Interestingly, this was canceled last minute without any explanation. So everybody expected a strong move in the direction of Musharraf declaring a state of emergency or something like that,
mm-hmm.
martial law, and it had been canceled last minute. Why, we don't know. But it seems that the leadership in Pakistan doesn't know what to do, doesn't know where it's going, and such hesitation can eventually take place before any announcement is made. There we see a government which is constantly shifting its position and visibly in a state of panic.
Also, what's very interesting here is that we have seen the re-emergence of two former prime ministers, primarily one, Benazir Bhutto, but also Nawaz Sharif. And Benazir Bhutto has been giving interviews. There have been news stories about her speculating on the possibility that she might go back to Pakistan, even though she could be arrested if she was, that there might be some possibility that she would go back to lend support to General Musharraf, or that she would go back and would participate in some sort of power-sharing agreement with him, or the possibility that she might herself stand again. She does, after all, lead the country's largest, what is arguably the largest opposition party, the Pakistan People's Party, although for the past 8 years she's been living outside of Pakistan. Does it surprise you that suddenly now we're starting to hear from Benazir Bhutto?
Well, this is not so sudden, actually. I mean, she had been discussing with the military for quite some time, and she had said very clearly that she wants to come back. The crisis creates an opportunity rather than anything else. What's interesting, on the contrary, is the fact that she's still persisting, apparently, in the same strategy. That is, she is well aware that the military is the force to reckon with in Pakistan anyway. And it makes sense in their own strategy to negotiate with them and try to see what, under what circumstances and under what kind of agreement she could come back. But in the meantime, we have at Karachi, where a number of supporters have been killed, deliberately so, by the MQM, which was working as a Musharraf proxy. In those circumstances, she keeps pursuing a strategy of negotiation with the military when her own party is increasingly uneasy about the same thing. So she's trying to both keep the support of her party and keep talking to the military. And in itself, this is much more surprising than the fact that she's coming back. The fact that she's coming back was on the table for quite some time. It's been discussed, refused, discussed again, and so on and so forth. This is not, there is nothing new really there. The fact that she's pursuing the same strategy now is a little bit more surprising.
What do you think is likely to happen with her? Do you think that she will go back, and under what circumstances? Or would you really say, at this point, no one really knows?
I mean, it's not impossible that she goes back. When this is still to be decided. For some time, she said quite openly that the summer would be decided, because that's the time when Musharraf was supposed to make his own decision regarding his own re-election and the timing of the re-election, whether he would be re-elected by the present assemblies or by the future assemblies, and whether he would or not keep his uniform. And depending on the answer that he would give to those two questions, then she would decide the date at which she would come back and decide whether she would confront him and look for some accommodation with him. So it's still difficult to say whether yes or no she will come back. She definitely, I think, keeps her options open and keeps saying that she will come back. Whether she will or not, I'm unable to say today.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Frederick Ra. He is a visiting scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's an expert and writer on South Asia. We're talking about Pakistan and what's been happening there recently, at least over the past couple of months. The questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, as I have read about this now over the past weeks, and people have speculated about what General Musharraf might do, they said, well, there are a number of things that I suppose he could do. Either he could just do nothing and hope that this dies down, and that seems not very likely to happen anytime soon. He could have do what it was speculated he might do, is actually stage a big crackdown and declare a state of emergency. I suppose that he also actually might say, all right, I agree with what many people say with their criticisms of the government. We do need real free and open elections. I'm going to make sure that happens. I will stand and let the people choose, and I will. And at the same time, what I will do is do what people have asked all these long, these many years. I will resign as head of the army. He could remold himself and perhaps indeed hang on. What do you think of the likelihood of a scenario like that?
I think it's extremely unlikely unless he's pushed out of his position. I mean, that could very well be the end result if he's told very nicely by his colleague from the army that the time has come for him to leave and leave nicely. Mm-hmm. In that sort of scenario, then that's the kind of discourse that we could eventually hear. But for the time being, we have no indication that he's planning to go in that direction. We have all indications that he wants to stick to his position, be reelected, and probably believe that he can still be reelected.
The army apparently has some sort of plan for succession if he should step aside or something should happen to him. And clearly, it seems that the army seems to expect to stay in control. Just how, I suppose, again, this is something that remains to be seen. Just what sort of a factor do you think the army is going to be in now, and what happens with the future of the country's leadership?
That, again, is difficult to say. I'm not aware of any specific plan of the army to remain in control, or any contingency plan in case Musharraf would disappear. But I see several possible scenarios. I mean, we could have the very simple replacement of a general by another general, and generals with political ambitions are not lacking. We could also have, and that in my view would eventually be more probable if Pervez Musharraf is pushed out, an army which decides that it's becoming too burdensome to assume the direct responsibility of power and withdraw behind the scene, a bit like in 1988 when Benazir came to power for the first time, and keep controlling the main leverage of power, manipulate things behind the scene, and let the civilian assume the day-to-day government. Then we would have a military government with a civilian face, and everybody, I believe, would be happy. At least, not necessarily in Pakistan, but at least abroad.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that it does seem that it would be a continuation of a pattern that we have seen before, with a swing back and forth between military control and civilian control. And that what happens is that people, for a while, they think the military brings order and stability, but then they become unhappy with that, and they want to have a civilian government, and they get that, but the civilian government, they think, well, they're corrupt, they're not doing a good job, maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing if the military took over. I think in 1999, there were some people that were sympathetic to General Musharraf and thought, well, maybe that wasn't such a bad thing, but now that they think all these years later, it's been too long. They have this problem with his dual identity, and that maybe it would be a good thing if they truly had civilian leadership again.
I think there is more than that. I mean, there was undeniably a sense of relief when Nawaz was ousted, because his government was such a mess. Mm. Then people didn't know where they were going anymore, and for some for a time there was some support for Pervez Musharraf, and I think that this cannot be denied. At the same time, there is a difference of nature in the government of Musharraf and even his military predecessors. I mean, on the one side, somebody like Ziaulak, for example, was probably as ruthless, if not more, than Musharraf is, but always knew when and how to compromise, who to co-opt, and so on and so forth. Musharraf is always, always choosing confrontation, systematically. Dialogue for him means compliance. Dialogue means to accept to be subdued. And that's it. And we have a regime which have, on the face of it, reinforced the institution when it has just used them to bypass them to a level which is absolutely unprecedented in the country. I mean, even program aimed at improving governance, such as devolution, for example, has been used not to decentralize, but to recentralize power by bypassing the provincial level and therefore the political parties, and establishing a new and direct client-patron relationship between the local level and the presidency. Therefore, he has created a lot of resentment in the middle. The same kind of attitude has prevailed in Balochistan, for example. I mean, the Baloch problem has been there forever, almost. And the kind of problem that Musharraf was faced with, both Benazir and Nawaz met it. And by the usual corruption, a bit of dialogue, and some representation of the leadership, they avoided the kind of trouble that we have now. As a result of all that, we don't have only the present crisis. We also have Balochistan, which is in flame. We have the MQM, which, although it is only qualified in this country as a pro-government organization, is actually a real fascist organization in the academic sense of the word, which is now controlling not only Karachi, but also part of urban Sindh. And remember that the MQM was very much behind the carnage of Karachi on May 12th. I mean, this is not just the erosion of popularity that any president would face in his position after 8 years. There is more than that. There is the nature of power has changed in Pakistan to a level unprecedented. And if you read the statement of Musharraf that you were quoting just before, there is also a loss of realism and a loss of any touch with reality. When he says, I'm obliged to do everything by myself, what does it mean? I mean, here is, we have a power which thinks that it is everything by itself, is not relying on everything, on anybody, has made the parliament a mockery, not that it was something great before, but at least it was never reduced to the role that it has now, and so on and so forth. So there is definitely a difference of nature in the kind of problems we see now and the kind of problems Pakistan has been facing in the past.
We are almost at our midpoint here. I have a caller we'll get right to. Frederic Grau is our guest. He's a visiting scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a leading expert and writer on South Asia. He served in the French embassy in Pakistan and from 1999 until 2003 in New Delhi as director of the Center for Social Sciences and Humanities. He's written extensively on security issues, Islamist movements, and sectarian conflict in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Charleston, Illinois, on our toll free line, line 4. We'll go right there. Hello.
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 Yes, go ahead.
Yes, a quick question. I have a feeling that we're going to hear from the government that his main problem and the issues are all related to Al Qaeda, and that is really behind all of this. And you haven't mentioned that so far, and I personally doubt that, but I would like to get your expertise, and this is a wonderful show, on what do you see the Al-Qaeda issues related to his presidency and also long-term. Thank you very much. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
I mean, first of all, it's not totally true that the Al-Qaeda, or let's say the terrorism issue, hasn't figured very high so far. I mean, it hasn't figured very high, you're right, but I mean, he did mention it in his address to the PMLQ parliamentarians yesterday, briefly, in what was a message essentially to the outside world. I said, look, I'm the one who combats extremism, I'm doing your war there, and therefore you need to support me. And that's probably the main problem. There are several answers we can give to this. Al-Qaeda, per se, has always been considered a liability for Pakistan's foreign policy, and therefore there has been a true cooperation between Pakistan and the United States, or Pakistan and whatever states needed to combat Al-Qaeda. And I think you can be credited for that. But at the same time, what we have observed, and that has generated a lot of support in the West for him, now, his cooperation was much less clear, for example, when it came to issues such as Afghanistan, where Pakistan, I think, is still clearly supporting the Taliban. It's not responsible for everything which is happening in Afghanistan. Let's be clear about that as well. But and what we have in the middle is also using the fact that the terrorist infrastructure that Musharraf had promised to dismantle has not been dismantled, to say, look, I'm cooperating with you in the war on terror, but should you push me too much or such and such issue, then I could look the other way when it comes to international terror. And we have seen that in the relation of Pakistan with the UK, for example, and implicitly also with the US, and let's say by and large the international community. So that is the factor which has generated the most support for Pervez Musharraf, in a sense also the most intellectual confusion about the nature of the regime, and which is largely responsible for him staying to power. Remember that before 2001, Pakistan was still a pariah state. Since 2001, that became a front line in the war on terror, and so on and so forth. But I mean, it has, because he has been supported on that issue, because also he has been praised for doing whatever he could against Al-Qaeda, then this also probably contributed to a large extent to his loss of sense of reality.
Clearly, the United States is, it's concerned in maintaining this relationship because Pakistan has long been considered an ally against terrorism. It was certainly, it goes back to the time of 9/11 and since, and before that, Pakistan was an important ally when the Soviets were in Afghanistan. So clearly, the United States feels that there are certain things it would like to see Pakistan do, and clearly also the United States is not quite sure that General Musharraf is doing as much as he should. At least that seemed to be the message when Vice President Cheney made a surprise visit there in February to deliver the message that that the United States was expecting Pakistan to do more. Having said all that, and having said that they, in fact, that they have made some progress, can you talk a little bit more about particularly the relationship between Pakistan and the United States, and do the current troubles that Mr. Musharraf is having, what exactly does that mean for the United States? And, how directly can the United States be seen to be addressing that?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I'm sure that's the question that the State Department, for example, is faced with at the moment. Clearly, the United States is afraid of losing what it does consider its best ally in the region. Clearly, the State Department is afraid of losing somebody whose cooperation may be flawed, but they, by and large, consider that even a flawed cooperation is better than no cooperation at all, and no one knows what would happen if he left power, or at least they say so. At the same time, they cannot be unaware that, he's losing control over the situation in Pakistan. So the dilemma they're faced with is, on the one side, if they stop showing support, they will precipitate his fall. But if they do show support, and they have done so far, they may indirectly encourage him to commit the kind of absurdities that he had done so far. I mean, if you look at the crisis since March 9, you see that all the trouble that he has been through has been created by himself. He takes one wrong decision after the other. Okay, in that kind of circumstances, keep supporting him strongly and vocally, more to the point. Just carry the message that, whatever he does will be acceptable. In other words, what that kind of message convey is that, repression is fine. Mm-hmm. Then what that kind of message define is the magnitude of the repression.
So what can the United States do if it, on the one hand, wants to see continued stability, perhaps wants to see General Musharraf continue to head the government, but does not want to be seen endorsing what might be an increasingly authoritarian regime? What sort of options does the United States have?
But, I mean, your question itself is a contradiction, because if they want to keep Musharraf, they accept in itself the idea of an authoritarian regime. So the question is really, should they be willing to support Musharraf at all costs? I mean, is Musharraf dispensable? I think so. Even a democratic regime is not a regime without an army. Even a democratic regime would not necessarily stop all cooperation with the United States. Things would eventually be done differently, but a number of issues we could argue quite easily that the support, the popular support, and certainly the efficiency of this popular support to the war on terror would be greater under some sort of democratic regime than on the situation that we have now. It doesn't mean that, everything would be perfect under a democratic regime, and past experience have shown that civilians were not without flaws either. But, I mean, there is also a cost to pay for the perpetration of the regime as it is and the problem that it is increasingly creating. And that is something I believe is not taking sufficiently in consideration.
Well, I suppose, too, here the United States has to go very carefully here, because it doesn't want to be seen as being directly involved in a change of government.
Yeah, no, but I understand the dilemma.
Yeah.
But let's face it, because of both the U.S. support to Musharraf, but also the way the Musharraf regime has used this support domestically. I mean, whenever there is a visit of any U.S. official, and the last visit by Dick Cheney was just another example, you have the Foreign Office all suddenly making big statements about Pakistan's sovereignty and all the rest of it. Even if they dismiss those statements an hour later, the message goes through to the population. You know, and the message is, me, Pervez Musharraf, I'm doing things under U.S. pressure, and there is nothing I can do about it. Okay? In other words, whatever wrong he does is systematically credited on the United States. So this is also creating a problem for the U.S.
Well, we have another caller here to bring in. Why don't we do that? Here where we are in Champaign County, line one. Hello?
Hi. I'm wondering about this MQM and... if you could expand on what it is, and does it have its own paramilitary, or is its military arm based in the more directly in the Pakistan armed forces? And bloodless coups must have some civilian support. And my understanding from the BBC reporting is that one of the constituencies was some part of what is called the Islamist political alignment. So. I don't know how. I know that's probably extremely complicated to give an idea of how, and it's probably quite fluid too. I would guess of where that so-called constituency, if one can even totalize it, is.
Constituency for what? Constituency for Musharraf?
Yeah, the BBC reports that, from what I understand, that there was either some kind of anti-modernist. Tendency, or some that he promised to pay them off, or there was some rejection of the democratic, besides just the corruption, etc. That and that Islamist alignments were part of what he regarded as his constituency. I think it's sometimes in what passes for a parliament, he relies on. It's hard to use the word moderate Islamist parties. In this context,
well, but you're referring to 1999, then.
Well, I'm talking about how bloodless coup needs to have some kind of constituency other than just the military. So, as I say, what I understand from the reporting is that part of his constituency is Islamist.
Okay. Well, there are several questions in yours. I mean, definitely, as I said before, there was a sense of relief all over the country about Nawaz's dismissal in 1999. And everybody, including Benazir Bhutto, greeted the coup at that time, expecting, of course, that they would benefit from it. As far as the Islamists are concerned, this is a different story. This is a different story because they had been systematically promoted by Pervez Musharraf, not for ideological reason, but purely geopolitical and political reasons. I mean, they had basically three functions. A, they played a foil vis-à-vis the outside world. So when they won, after a series of manipulation, in the elections in the two provinces adjacent to Afghanistan, Musharraf was sending to the world the following message. I'm under Islamic pressure, and if you push me too much, I mean, the entire country will be taken over by those guys. I mean, the fact is that the center, they only had 11.10%. So they were not really a force to reckon with. Now he's been using them practically in a number of specific issues, such as Afghanistan, for example, through the GUI in particular. And third, they're useful eventually for any kind of pressure to be broken under the other political parties or any kind of alliance that he needs politically to bring about some political change. The example is the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment changed the nature of the political regime in Pakistan from a parliamentarian one to a presidential one. Now, Pervez Musharraf can dismiss the parliament, can dismiss the prime minister, and name the governors, and is the number one, the president is the number one leader in the country, which was not the case before. The president was essentially an honorary function, that was it. In the process which led to that, he made a series of promises to the Islamists, and he couldn't have got the vote that he needed, which was two-thirds majority in the parliament, without them. So there was clearly an alliance, although officially they are in the opposition. Now, having them officially in the opposition is very convenient too, because Pervez Musharraf has decided the most important party of the opposition was the MMA, the Mutahida Quality Movement, which is actually an alliance of six Islamist parties. Those six Islamist parties are not a party per se, they are an alliance of parties. Yet they were made by the grace of Pervez Musharraf, the most important party, when the biggest opposition party is actually the PPP. As a result, it was Fazlur Rahman, the leader of the MMA, which represented the opposition within the National Security Council instead of the leader of the PPP. Okay? So, in other words, he uses the coalition the way he wants to, and through an alliance with those people, he gets a free hand. That's what happened over the first few years of his presidency. The MQM is something different. The MQM is a party of Muhajir, migrants from India. They were represented initially, essentially, in Karachi. And they've always been a violent party. They're not a paramilitary organization per se, but they've always been a very violent organization. They still are. I mean, what happened on May 12 is the best demonstration of that. And again, there has been an alliance of Pervez Musharraf with those people. First of all, he is one of them. He is also a migrant from India. And in 1999, when he took over, the MQM was still an organization to reckon with in Karachi, but was a declining organization. He has, to some extent, revitalized the organization, and he's using it whenever he needs to pressurize other organizations. We spoke just before of the alliance with the Islamists. But he can, in Karachi, for example, specifically, he uses the MQM whenever he doesn't want the Islamists to become too powerful. And there is a sort of triangular relationship between the PPP, the Jamaat Islami, and the MQM, when any alliance between two of them can be used against the third party, or one party against another one, which is considered too threatening or too powerful by the center. And this is the kind of game that we have seen over the years.
And that's a hard one to play. Thank you. Could you say a few more words about Baluchistan, and how your earlier reference to it was that it was in flames, and what kind of forces does he have to play with there, or is that out of control? Thanks, Alice.
I mean, it's difficult to say what the situation really is in Baluchistan, because there is a complete blackout of information from there. So the kind of information that you can get is either from the government or from the nationalists themselves. So in both cases, you can imagine that it's a little biased, and that's clearly another statement. What's interesting about Baluchistan, there always been a strong Baluch nationalism. At the same time, when Pervez Musharraf took over, we had several decades of slow yet real integration. What the Baluch were basically asking is a greater share of the resources produced by their own province, in particular gas and oil, and more autonomy according basically to the constitution. And that was refused. So the government has been blaming the Sadas, the tribal chiefs, for refusing development, refusing a number of things. And there was certainly an element of that. But what he has done, more to the point, is make sure that none of the traditional leaders would be represented either at the provincial government or the provincial assembly or at the center in Islamabad. And this lack of representation has only precipitated everything. So again, what we see in Baluchistan is sort of a crisis of democracy. And people were initially perhaps difficult negotiator, but ready to negotiate with the government, has been pushed to the side and gradually radicalized. That has been at the cost of many disappearances. That has been at the cost of illegal detention. That has been at the cost of murder eventually. And again, this is very much related to the crisis that we see now, because if you remember the reason why Judge Chaudhry was sacked, this was one element. This was maybe not the main element, but he was known and had exasperated the military government for condemning those disappearances, illegal detention, and so on and so forth. And he was himself a Baloch.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Frederick Grar. He is a visiting scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's an expert and writer on South Asia and has written a lot on security issues, on Islamist movements, and sectarian conflict in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. And we're talking about recent events in Pakistan, and questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I wonder if I just might shift a little bit, as I know we've been talking about Pakistan, but I was interested if you could say something about what is going on now between India and the United States, and the fact that we know now that for the past couple of years at least, I think the United States has tried to improve its relations with India, and as part of that, announced a deal that would help India develop its civilian nuclear power sector and hopefully get them to rein in their ambitions to further develop nuclear weapons. And it was announced a couple of years ago and it really hasn't gotten very far. Is it possible that both countries are going to come back to that? And I suppose ultimately I'm interested in how the relationship between India and the United States perhaps complicates the relationship between the United States and Pakistan.
Well, there's certainly definitely two different problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll start perhaps with the latter. The rapprochement between India and the United States is certainly not welcome in Islamabad. And seen with some apprehension, not the least because it does mean an increased marginalization of Pakistan itself. And that only put pressure on Pakistan to reassert its role, for example, in Afghanistan, by saying, look, there is nothing you can do in Afghanistan without me, and therefore I am very important, you have to cultivate me, and that's what happened in effect. At the same time, Pakistan is no longer in a position where it can continue with low-intensity conflict with India, and therefore we cannot yet speak of a peace process because this is the actual expression, but I mean, let's say that engagement would be more appropriate to describe the reality of Pak-India relationship at the moment. Now, regarding the agreement, I don't think that any of the two main contenders, the U.S. and India, wants to go back on what has been said. And the two countries have gone a long way. But it's quite clear that we are approaching the end of negotiation, that things are being increasingly technical, that people are getting increasingly nervous about not being trapped into an agreement which will be to their disadvantage. And as always, at the end of a negotiation, you do have a situation where things seems extremely tense and more difficult than likely to derail at any time. I don't think we're there yet. Ultimately, I still want to believe that wisdom will prevail and the agreement will be signed.
Mm. As you said,
too much to lose for India. Mm. There'll probably be too much to lose for the U.S. as well.
Yeah. And as you said, it's not surprising that in Pakistan, the government of Pakistan wouldn't be real happy about India and the United States becoming closer just because of the long animosity between India and Pakistan. On the other hand, I don't imagine it's something that the government of Pakistan could do anything about.
No, of course not. There is nothing they can do. Plus, this administration has made very clear what they call the diaphanation of relations between the U.S. and Pakistan on the one side, the U.S. and India on the other side. This is only a partial diaphanation. The issue are inevitably linked. But no, they can't be happy about it, especially since they always considered the United States as the only real protector against India. But I guess that there's something that they can't really prevent. It's not sure they really want to prevent it either, because it's convenient to have somebody able to speak to both parties whenever there is a problem. But as you said, there is nothing they can really do against it anyway.
Mm. There also has been some increasing tension perhaps between the governments of Pakistan and Afghanistan having to do with the allegations that Pakistan is not doing enough about al-Qaeda and particularly Taliban at the border, in this border region between the two countries. Is there significant tension between those two governments, and is that something that's particularly important for particularly for for Pakistan?
I think it's much more this is certainly significant to start with. Mm. This is probably much more important for Afghanistan than for Pakistan. For Afghanistan, it is essentially a border problem. But Afghanistan is a complete contradiction all the time because it is constantly claiming that Pakistan is violating a border that does not recognize itself. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for Pakistan to denounce sort of a duplicity on the part of Afghanistan. Now, clearly the Afghan claims are unacceptable to Pakistan. How could they accept that at the very least the NWFP, the Pashtun province of Pakistan, be joined to Afghanistan? Be merged to Afghanistan. This is something which is simply unacceptable. On the other side, this border issue is manageable for Pakistan. I mean, this is not something that they like, but this is something that they have and continue and will live with anyway. The problem is different for Pakistan. The problem is that this can be instrumentalized by India to create a sort of alliance with Afghanistan and create sort of a double front for Pakistan, which would be, of course, very uncomfortable in case of another conflict with India.
It has, returning, we were talking earlier about the fact that there has been some criticism, and some of it certainly come from the United States, of Pakistan and the government of Pakistan not doing enough to deal with potential terrorists on the border, and particularly here we're talking about this border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan, there are Taliban there apparently, and the criticism has been of Pakistan has been made that they're not doing enough. Do you think that is a fair criticism?
No, I don't know if it's a fair criticism, but this is definitely not an accurate description. Mm-hmm. Pakistan is not just doing enough. Pakistan is doing too much. Pakistan is actively supporting a number of elements, and this is quite clear. And if you remember the article in the New York Times last week, when it was General Jones mentioned a few occasions when, although NATO, for example, had been calling on the Pakistani side to stop some infiltration, which were happening just a few meters or a few hundred meters far from them, there was either no reply to the phone call or no action. Pakistan is actively supporting a number of elements. So there is some substance in it. Now, this is not the entirety of the problem. Basically, in Afghanistan, we identify three tiers in the Taliban. The core ideological element, which seems to be supported by Pakistan on the one side, the Afghan Taliban, with whom at some point an agreement with the Kabul government may be possible, and the spoilers, the people who simply benefit from the chaos or the insecurity situation to fill up their pockets with whatever they can. And Pakistan is not responsible for everything. Yet, at the same time, solving the Pakistan problem for Afghanistan is an insufficient yet necessary condition to move forward in the process.
Certainly, it seems to be true that going back now to the time when Taliban were in control of Afghanistan, that this was supported by Pakistan, or at mm-hmm. least by elements of the Pakistani government and military, perhaps in large part because they were just interested in having a government that they could potentially influence, or at least that they would be allied with. Now, with the Taliban no longer in power, does the continued support for Taliban, is that on the Pakistani part just a matter of habit, or do they see that as an investment in the future, in possible return of Taliban to power?
No, I don't think we're exactly in the same situation, the one which prevailed in before 2001. Hmm. I'm not sure, for example, that the Pakistani are supporting the Taliban because they want the Taliban to seize power in Kabul. They want to put as much pressure on the Afghan government as they can to force it to be more compliant. They would like, for example, less pro-Pashtunistan element. We just mentioned this sentiment before, less pro-Pashtunist element in the government. But they will also make sure that Afghanistan doesn't become, again, an ally of India. And that's really an obsession there.
So it's still a matter of the government of Pakistan wanting to have the most cooperative, compliant government, or at least they want to have its policy align. That is, they want to have the policy of the government of Afghanistan align with their own policy.
Yes, to a large extent. But there is more to it. I mean, one former DGI, Syed Durrani, wrote some weeks ago that, in a way, whoever is in power in Kabul will have to deal with Islamabad, which I think is true. We should also consider what we said before. I mean, Pakistan fears being increasingly marginalized and need Western support. As long as the West, and by that I mean essentially NATO, ISAF, is present in Afghanistan, no other regional actor will be able to develop a predominant influence in Afghanistan. So it is in the interest of Pakistan also to maintain sort of a low-intensity conflict without being involved too much, but with making sure that things go on. I mean, and this is a complex situation where Pakistan has probably not totally identified yet its final objective, but where you can identify elements of a policy which all go in the same direction, which is let's keep supporting elements of the Taliban. Let's make sure that things do not settle completely.
And just very quickly here, I'm sure in these interviews we always come to the point of when I ask, so what do you think is going to happen next with the kind of conflict that we've been talking about in Pakistan with General Musharraf, his future, the future of the government? How do you think this is likely to play out?
I mean, this is premature to say how it's likely to play out. I mean, as you know, Pakistan is a country full of surprise, and you never get bored when you study it. But what I think, and I don't think I'm taking too much of a risk here, is that this is the end of the Musharraf show. The question is not whether it will go, but when and how. And this is still an open question.
All right. Well, there we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Frederick Grauer. He is visiting scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you, Dr. Grauer, very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.